So as Nira just shared, for the past 12 years, I've served as a Rabbitson in the United States, 4 years in Houston and 8 years in Charleston. And I will tell you, I'm from the Five Towns. I grew up in North Woodmere, and I never, ever thought that I'd be living in Texas or in South Carolina. I remember when my husband and I got married, so I was already a Jewish educator, and we knew he wanted to be a shul rabbi. So on the program that we gave out, we thanked all of our guests for coming to the wedding, and we said that we hope you'll join us on our road, wherever we may go, wherever we may stop over on the way to Eretz Yisrael. And when we were in South Carolina, we would look at each other and laugh, like, we didn't really think that this was going to be where we were going to be. We thought like maybe Teaneck, not, you know, Texas or South Carolina. But we got a lot from our experiences. It was a really very special time. And that's what I want to share with you today. So a little bit about my upbringing. As I said, I grew up in the Five Towns. My entire family was from. Everyone in my family, we only knew people in New York. Like, there was no one in our family even from New Jersey. We had some second cousins in Boston, but really everyone was in New York and everyone was from. When I met my husband, it was a bit of a culture shock to our family because he was from Chicago. And my parents like weren't sure what to do with this. We didn't realize that you had to host out of town people when they come in for a wedding. We teased my parents mercilessly. It was like a little bit true, maybe a little bit not, that before our ofrah, when we were flying to Chicago, that we had to go to the airport. We didn't have to go 4 hours in advance because we said the only time they ever fly out of New York is to Israel. So they figured you have to be at the airport 4 hours early. We had really never dealt with this out of New York thing. What else I found fascinating when I met my husband was actually that he had an aunt who was intermarried. I was like fascinated by this because I'd never heard of anybody who had intermarried before. You can all laugh at me. God certainly is, because my life in Charleston certainly taught me a lot. So we lived in Washington Heights. We went to Gross in Israel. My husband finished his smicha there. And then he got the Kiruv bug. He really, really wanted to go into Kiruv. I wasn't so into it. I had been teaching Torah Shbaal Peh in New York before we went to Israel. And I was like, why don't we go somewhere like Teaneck? And he's like, no, let's go out of town and do Kiruv. So that's what we did. We went to Houston. And I remember on Sukkot, we had this guy over and I was trying to make small talk. I've learned since then, it's just not a good idea. So I asked him, oh, where do you live? And he tells me this area that's like 2 miles away from where we were living. And I said, oh, that's a long walk. And he said, yeah, but I didn't walk. And I said, oh, where are you sleeping? And he said, I'm not sleeping in anyone's house. And he looks at me and he said, I drove. And I said, oh, okay. P.S. This man has since he became very close with my husband. They learned a lot. He made Aliyah and is today from. And that was one of the first stories, amazing stories of journeys that we were going to see. But that was the first education from the New Yorker who learned that not everyone in the world is like a New York from world. I got used to the people driving to Shul on Shabbos. Houston was mostly a modern Orthodox community. Definitely people who did drive, definitely people who weren't from, but more or less a modern Orthodox community that my parents were comfortable with when they came to visit. And then we moved to Charleston. My husband was an assistant rabbi in Houston, and in Charleston, he was gonna be the Shul rabbi there. So the first introduction that I had to Charleston was on our Prabha. I was sitting in Shul, talking to someone, once again, making small talk, once again, learning that that's not necessarily a good idea. And I asked him, so what do you do for a living? And he tells me, I own a seafood store. And I was like, oh, okay, that's very interesting. And then he says, yeah, actually we sell kosher food at our seafood store. And I'm thinking that's really weird. That can't possibly be kosher if they're selling food from a seafood store. I later found out that Chabad actually had an arrangement that Chabad made meals that were double wrapped that they would sell from the seafood store. It's actually one of the most famous seafood stores in Charleston, owned by a family that two of the people in the family have since made Aliyah and are from. The man who owns the store is an incredibly special man, a big Baal Chesed. But that was definitely my first introduction on our Prabha. The second one is Erev Yom Kippur. I was sitting in the shul kitchen and we were preparing the breakfast that they have after shul. And I was talking to this woman and she says to me, you don't actually fast on Yom Kippur, do you? And I said, yes. And she said, oh, but you have kids. I thought you don't have to fast if you have children. So I'm not really sure how to respond to this. And she says, well, I guess I'm a bad Jew because I don't really fast on Yom Kippur. And I'm like, okay. A reaction I learned to have many times. My husband once was at Minyan and I came to Minyan with him because I really enjoyed going to Minyan. And one man was talking about how after Minyan, he's going to go to an oyster party. Again, I had never seen an oyster in my life. And I'm hearing about Jews who are going from Minyan to eat oysters. Definitely a very interesting experience. It wasn't all funny though. I mean, I guess that's not so funny, but it was a little shocking in a funny, little humorous way. But the next story wasn't really so humorous. My husband comes home from work one day, like white as a sheet. And he said to him, so how was your day? And he says to me that he spent his day talking to a Christian woman. She was married to a Holocaust survivor who had passed away. And his burial plan was to be cremated. And my husband could not get over, how can a Holocaust survivor want to be cremated? And he was sitting and talking to this Christian woman, explaining to her the importance of Jewish burial, but especially for a Holocaust survivor, how important it is to be, have a Jewish burial. And that was the first of many situations where he had to convince a spouse that the Jewish member should be buried properly. And Baruch Hashem, this person was buried properly. But it was a shocking experience to realize that a Jewish person, a Holocaust survivor, would be married to someone who was not Jewish and that he would want to be cremated. Back to the humorous level, we'll go in a second. So this story happened our last year in Charleston, towards the end of our tenure. It was our last Yom Kippur in Charleston. My husband's giving an impassioned speech at Ne'ilah, telling everyone how tshuva, tefillot, staka, ma'avir, net ruach gezerah. I'm used to translating, so I will translate here, that tshuva and davening and giving charity will save us from death. And apparently it was a very effective speech, because after Yom Kippur, my husband saw that someone had actually given a large amount of tzedakah during Ne'ilah. As soon as he finished speaking, while everyone's davening Shemona Esrei, this man was on his phone giving tzedakah. We actually saw that there were some non-Jews who were actually even more into Judaism than the Jews themselves. So I'll share a few more humorous stories. That one year, it's Rosh Hashanah. It was one of the first Rosh Hashanahs we were there. And the Baal Tokeo, who's my husband, is blowing the shofar. And each time he blows the shofar, there's a woman, an African-American woman, who's standing in shul wearing a huge turban on her head. And with each tekiah blast, she screams out, "Hallelujah!" So everybody knows you're supposed to be quiet during shofar blowing. So of course it falls to the Rebbetzin that I'm the one who has to tell her to please stop. And everyone's giving me dirty looks. You have to say something. So I walk up to the woman and I explain to her, "Do you mind please keeping quiet? It's a very sensitive moment right now. We're all trying to pray." And she says, "I'm full of prayer and my prayer is calling out to the Lord. And that's why I have to scream out, hallelujah. Don't you have to do that too?" And I said, "Do you mind crying out to the Lord in a quieter voice, not to interrupt everyone?" And it happened a few times, and each time I had to tell her, "Do you mind stopping?" So that was definitely a very awkward moment. But there was another more awkward moment when there was a man who came into shul who looked homeless and smelled homeless. We later found out wasn't Jewish, and he was listening to my husband's speech. It was Parsha Yitro, and my husband was speaking about the Ten Commandments, and he was talking about idolatry. And again, that must have been a very effective speech, because after shul, after Shabbos, we see in the newspapers that there was a man who went around to different churches in Charleston and broke idols, because he had heard in synagogue that day that we're not supposed to do idol worship. And he actually called my husband to bail him out of jail, which he didn't. Like, this guy was clearly mentally unstable, but he had heard my husband speak about not worshiping idols and felt he had to break all the idols in Charleston. So that was our experience in Charleston. But the most shocking experiences for me, certainly as a New York Jew, was seeing the level of intermarriage that we saw in Charleston. It was so rampant, you couldn't even say in a speech, both at school or at shul, I worked in the school, you couldn't say intermarriage was bad, because you would risk offending a very large percentage of the congregation. That was how rampant intermarriage was. Funnily, I always say that I wanted to marry a rabbi. When I was 19 years old, I read Tales Out of a Shul by Rabbi Emanuel Feldman, which is a fantastic book, highly recommended. And I decided I wanted to marry a rabbi and I wanted to live in the South. That's not why I married my husband. He's a wonderful person. But basically, I lived out what my dream was, or Rabbi Emanuel Feldman's story was. If you read his book, in the 1950s, what Atlanta was then is what Charleston is today. And in his book, he rails against intermarriage, and he talks about how people are closing the door on Judaism when they intermarry. And I was all about that when I came down to Charleston. I'm like, how could people turn their backs on their heritage when they intermarry? And I really was all bought into what he was saying, and I still am. But it's seeing the personal stories, I have a very different understanding now of why people intermarry. When a person lives in Charleston, basically, if you're going to send your kids to the public school there, as many people do, there's no Jewish high school in Charleston, which was one of the main reasons that we left. My daughter graduated eighth grade. So many people don't feel strong enough to send their children out of town for high school, or they can't afford it. And they send their kids to the public schools. And if you're going to send your Jewish child to the public schools, and there's so few Jewish children, and they're not really that strong in their Judaism themselves, very often their kids don't really stand a chance, because they're going to go to the prom and, you know, they want to go with someone. They, you know, and there's not really Jewish people to choose from. So they're going to just hang out with this non-Jewish kid. It's not really serious. And the next thing you know, you become familiar with dating non-Jews, and only a few short years later, they're engaged to one. Same thing with college. So many people choose to send their children to the colleges, the state colleges, because it's, you know, very cheap tuition. And it's very difficult to pay for expensive out-of-state tuition. So they send their children to the colleges there, and they say, oh, they have a Hillel. The Hillel serves non-kosher food, and they have their breakfast before Yom Kippur ends, but we'll leave that aside. But basically, it's very, very hard for these kids who maybe don't have the strongest Jewish foundation, or even if they do, to stay strong in their Jewish beliefs. And many children end up dating and marrying non-Jewish people from college. Even the people who are very passionate and felt strongly about marrying somebody Jewish, many people date people, they think they're dating somebody who's Jewish, and when they comes to, they're engaged, and they want to speak to the rabbi about getting married, and the rabbi does some research into the background, they find out that a mother converted conservative, a grandmother conservative reform, it happens more often than not, actually. And many people found out afterward, but they were already in committed relationships, and it's very difficult to step away from a committed relationship when you love someone, and you find out somebody, your person you're engaged to, is not Jewish. There were people who had been married for many, many years, who had children, who would later on find out actually their spouse was not halakhically Jewish, and it was heartbreaking. I'm going to tell you a story in a few minutes about a woman who was part of our community, who actually went through an amazing conversion, and I wrote an article about her, and one of our congregants read the article and was like, oh my God, I just found out that my mother converted conservative, and I guess that means that maybe I'm not halakhically Jewish. And her husband, he got married very late because he only wanted to marry a woman who was Jewish. And he was just stunned, anguished. And they thought about her converting, but they weren't ready to embark on a from lifestyle. They weren't ready to keep Shabbos and keep Kashrut. And they weren't really sure what to do. And to this day, they're in that limbo state. They haven't told their children because they're not ready to tell them you're not halakhically Jewish. But it's a very difficult situation. We met many people who were further on in that kind of situation and who had become frum over the course of their lives and found out that they themselves weren't halakhically Jewish, and it creates a tremendous identity crisis. Even if they're frum already and the conversion path is actually quite simple, once you're already frum, it's very difficult to think your entire life that you were Jewish only to find out years later that maybe your conversion wasn't, and it's very, very difficult. I can't tell you how many times in Charleston I would be talking to someone and they would tell me, I was adopted, or my mother was adopted. And in New York or in a big Jewish community, very often that means they went through a halakhic conversion. But in Charleston, almost always that doesn't. If a person hasn't become frum on their own, as most people in Charleston are not, that generally means that either there was a reform conversion, a conservative conversion, or no conversion at all. And this happened by prominent members of the community. They would be telling me, oh, I was adopted. And I'm like, oh, okay. In my mind, oh my God. A clergy person once told me that his mother was adopted, and I know he's not Shomer Shabbos in any way, nor was his mother. And again, like the shock in my head, like, oh my God, this person isn't halakhically Jewish either. It was really, really shocking. To the point, we got to Charleston in 2013, and it was 2012, and in 2013, there was a very famous Pew report that came out that spoke about the lengths of assimilation and how terrible it was. And had I read that Pew report a few years before when I was a New York Jew, I would have been shocked like everybody else. But when I read that, I was like, wow, the numbers really aren't as bad as I thought, because that was the extent of the stories of assimilation that we saw in Charleston. What's really ironic is that so many assimilated Jews observe Hanukkah. And in effect, what's the story of Hanukkah? It's the story about our victory over Hellenism, where in fact, so many of these assimilated Jews who are celebrating the story of Hanukkah are really living lives of Hellenists. It's a little bit of an irony. I'm a little bit depressing you right now. So I want to share that with all the stories of the Mityavnim, of the Hellenists, we saw so many stories of Maccabim, of Jews who really came so far from where they had come. And those are the stories that I want to share with you. Growing up in the five towns, it was very, very easy to be frum. It was very easy to keep Shabbos. It was very easy to keep kosher. There was 1,000 restaurants, probably not 1,000, but many, many different restaurants. If you want to go out for pizza, it's just which pizza store do I want to go to? In Charleston, there was not even one kosher restaurant. There was nothing. Shabbos, you know, it was not an easy thing to keep Shabbos in Charleston. When we send our kids to the day school, so this one day school goes through eighth grade, and it's a community school, which basically means that your children, if they keep Shabbos, they're one of the few kids in the class who keep Shabbos. My daughter, who just graduated eighth grade, was the only kid in her class to be Shomer Shabbos. And you would hear kids making plans to go out here on Friday night, here on Shabbos day, this non-kosher restaurant. I remember vividly one story that really broke my heart about one of the shlichim. One of the shlichim in Charleston had a son who was in eighth grade, and he was the only frum kid in the class. And it was Erev Yom Kippur, so it was a half day of school. And all the kids in the class were talking about which non-kosher restaurant they were going to after school that day on Erev Yom Kippur. And this kid was the only one who couldn't go because he is Shomer Shabbos. And it was really, really difficult. I was just talking to a friend of mine who's in Charleston now. And she said, you know, my kid comes home from fourth grade nursery and he's sitting there and he's talking about Halloween and he's saying how difficult it is. I wish we were different, that we would also be able to celebrate Halloween like all the other kids. It was really difficult to be different in Charleston. It was difficult to keep kosher in Charleston. It was difficult to keep Shabbos in Charleston. Just tell you a little bit about what it is to keep kosher in Charleston. Forget no kosher restaurants. When we first got there, you couldn't get kosher meat. You would order meat from a delivery in Atlanta, and it would come every 6 weeks. You really had to be very organized, which I very often wasn't, and you had to keep everything in a spare freezer, and that was how you got kosher meat. 2 years ago, I guess now it was 3 years ago, it was 2 years before we left Charleston, Trader Joe's started stocking kosher meat. And I remember standing in the grocery store with like tears coming down my face, thinking, wow, I get to be a normal person and not plan my like meals 6 weeks in advance to think about what kind of meat I would need. I can go to the store and get fresh ground beef and make meatballs like anybody else. That was how difficult it was to keep kosher in Charleston. The mikvah. Our mikvah was built in the 1950s, and it was hot pink, which I guess was the style in the 1950s, and there was no filter in the mikvah, which meant that any time a woman had to use the mikvah, my husband had to fill the mikvah with water 2.5 hours before with hot water, and then drain it after each use. Tremendous waste of water, and also a tremendous time difficulty for him. It meant that if a woman was going to tell me in an hour before I have to go to the mikvah, that would mean she would have to go late at night. Very often there were issues with filling the mikvah, and there were many times a woman would come to the mikvah and the water, the heater didn't work and the water was freezing cold, and she would actually have to go into a freezing cold mikvah. Just like when you hear about in Poland in years back in Russia, there were women in this day and age in 2020, still to today, who are going to freezing cold mikvahs in Charleston. On the flip side, there were times when the temperature in the mikvah changed a little bit, because the weather outside affected what the temperature was when it was filling, and the water was boiling hot. And there were times when a woman either had to wait for the water to cool off, or she would say, I need to go right now, and she would go into a boiling hot mikvah. Basically, what I'm describing to you right now, the Shabbos situation, the kashrut situation, the mikvah situation, leaves a situation where you would think not that many people are really going to choose to become frum. It is not a simple situation to be frum in Charleston. I'll add one other piece that was difficult, minyan. Our minyan was downtown, and many of the people did not live downtown. On Shabbos, most of the people who came to shul drove to shul. But even the daily minyan was in our downtown campus. They've been having minyan for, our shul is a very, very historic shul. They say that they never missed a minyan during the Civil War, which is pretty cool. But it was difficult to find people to come to minyan. Many people had to drive 10 to 15, if not 20 minutes to come to our minyan. Often they were driving back in traffic, and it was difficult. We had minyan 3 times a day. My husband wouldn't have come to the shul if not, but it was difficult very often to get a minyan. And there was a lot of siyata d'shmaya, a lot of Hashem's help in making the minyan. I remember there were times on Shabbos afternoon that we would have 8 people, and someone would stand outside and look around, maybe he'll find some random Jew on the street. And almost always that would happen, that a random Jew would be passing by and you'd be like, all right, I'll make your minyan. And very often we got 10 that way. There was a lot of miracles in making our minyan in Charleston, but it was very, very difficult to have that minyan in Charleston. They only had 1 minyan. Very often it was very early in the morning, and on days off, you know, days when it was days off for people, they didn't really want to wake up in the morning to go to minyan, and it was very, very difficult. With that said, with all of the difficulties of Shabbos, of Kashrus, of minyan, of mikvah, I can't tell you how many people turned to an observant life while we were in Charleston. In the 8 years we were there, we saw so many miracles. When we came, there was no one with children. There was no one. We were the ones with children. There was one other family who had a kid in high school and a kid in sixth grade who have since made Aliyah, but there was no one else. And slowly, during our time there, people fell from the sky and they moved to Charleston, young couples, they became frum. We had so many weddings, we had so many babies born in our community, many of them who became frum. when I think about, you know, my husband obviously had, when he did weddings, so I had to give challah classes to the women. And many of the women I gave challah classes to were not from at all when I gave them those challah classes. And when I think back to how many challah classes I gave to these women, the majority of them continued going to our mikvah. And a lot of them were not from and continued to be not from, but they continued to use our mikvah. And they also had those experiences where sometimes it was cold and sometimes it was hot. Many of these women had pregnancy losses or difficulty becoming pregnant, and they still felt such meaning in coming to the mikvah that many of them continued going. Our minyan, there were so many powerful stories about our minyan. I want to share a few of them with you. And we saw that it was difficult to make a minyan. So some of the kids in our school started at, 7:45, and minyan was at 7. Some of these kids who lived really 20 minutes away said, we want to come to minyan. Some of these kids were not from, but they felt it was so important when they became bar mitzvah that they wanted to contribute to our minyan, that they had their parents drive them to 20 minutes to shul and then the 20 minutes back, sometimes in traffic, to get to school. And people drove carpools to bring kids to shul because they felt it was important. We're bar mitzvah, now we can contribute. And they really started to come to our minyan, including many kids who are not from. There's a beautiful story about a man in our shul. His family was very, very involved in the shul, but he went to shul for his bar mitzvah. And after that, like so many others, he dropped off and stopped coming to shul. And he had a difficult life, and his father passed away, and he was very close with his father, and he decided he wanted to start coming to minyan to say kaddish for his father. And his sister decided she wanted to come as well. And very few people, his mother included, thought he would really be able to come 3 times a day for minyan. He had a really, really difficult life. He was really struggling. No one really thought he would make it, but he did. And while he was coming to shul, he became such a member of our shul, such an important person in our shul who was so connected. I think now he's a vice president of the shul now. And he started to come over and over again to our shul, and he decided he wanted to start davening for the Amud. But his davening, his Hebrew was not really very good, so he started to learn with people so that he would be able to daven for the Amud. And his Hebrew started to become better and better, and everyone in the shul would cheer him on, and he felt so good about himself. And it was about a year after his father passed away. They used to do a really cute thing in our shul. My shul people are so cute. So for my husband's birthday, they wanted to do something special for his birthday. So they figured, what makes the rabbi happier than having a big minyan? So they would do like this call out to everybody in the shul, and they would all surprise the rabbi for his birthday. And they would all like pack the shul a little bit early, people who would never come, men, women, everyone. And then they would have a birthday cake in the back. They would get him his favorite sefer. So he would come into shul, and they would all expect my husband to have this look of shock, but he always knew it was coming. So my husband is like a master at keeping a straight face, and he'd be like, rabbi, where's the shocked face? But like my husband would just continue on with his class as usual between mincha and maariv, not showing any shock at all. But there was a woman from Brooklyn, a frum woman from Brooklyn. We had a lot of tourists in Charleston. It's actually the number one tourist destination in the U.S. So we had this woman who was talking to me in the back, and she came during this birthday celebration. And she said to me, do you have a lot of people who are FFB from, you know, New York who moved to Charleston? And I said, no, not really. Everyone here is either a Balchuva or a Ger or not from. No, we don't really have anybody who's an FFB here. And she said, but what about that guy who davened for the Amud? His Hebrew is like perfect. He sounds like a New Yorker. And I'm just like looking at her, and I'm like, the tears are coming from my face. And I said to her, this man just started learning Hebrew this year. Like, aside from what he'd learned in Hebrew school many, many years ago, this is brand new for him. And she was in shock. And I went to get him, and I said to him, you have to hear what this woman has to say. And I brought him over and his mother. And he had such a look of pride and accomplishment on his face. Look how far I've come. And we had so many beautiful stories like that. We had the story of a man who came to our table. He was a lawyer, and he was very close with a woman who's from, and she said, I think you should have him over for your Friday. And he was sitting at our table, and we were making chit-chat. We had a really good meal, and it was during the primaries before the previous election. And somehow Hillary Clinton came up, and I'm sorry for getting political, but like since Hillary kissed Suha Arafat many, many years ago, I wasn't a fan of hers. And I said, like, I'm not a big fan of Hillary Clinton. Okay, whatever. That was part of the conversation. We went on to other things. We finished a meal, and I said to my husband, wow, that was a great meal. He's such a great guy. And my husband said, we will never see him again. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, he's very, very liberal. And I said, oh. P.S. Not only did this guy continue coming back, he became Shomer Shabbos, Shomer Kashrus. He had his wedding in our shul, I think it was about 2 years later. His wife is the treasurer of the shul. She's a Judaic teacher in the school, and they are from member of our community now. That was one story. There's another story of a couple we met like 2-3 years ago, and he came to our table. He was Israeli, Sephardi, but not from at all, with his non-Jewish girlfriends. And we started to learn with them. And since we've moved, he has reached out to my husband and told him, I need that letter to say that I'm Jewish because we're planning to make Aliyah and my girlfriend is planning to go through an Orthodox conversion. Many, many stories like this. But the most powerful story that we experienced in Charleston, I will tell you right now, like really such a powerful story. When we moved to Charleston, or when we were interviewing, one of the people on the board used to call us all the time, and she probably shouldn't have done this, but she said, I really want y'all to come to Charleston. And she had the strongest Southern accents. And I was like, wow, if everybody has an accent like that in Charleston, for sure we should come there. So we moved to Charleston. We find out she's actually from Wilmington, North Carolina, and no one else has an accent like that. But we became very close with her and her husband. Her husband had been a founder of the day school. I think actually it was his father who was a founder of the day school, but he was very involved. And he was also very involved with the shul. They weren't from, but really very important members of the shul. They had one daughter who had moved to New York, very from family in New York, but all the other kids who had stayed in Charleston were not from, and many grandchildren. And one of the grandchildren was dating a girl who wasn't Jewish. And okay, that was the story. The grandfather passed away, and shortly afterward, this grandson, this redheaded grandson, came with his non-Jewish girlfriend to my husband, and they said, she wants to go through an Orthodox conversion. And my husband's looking at them, they're like this gorgeous couple who's like, you know, successful and like party couple. And he's like, right, you know, I have many such meetings that are one-time meetings. They don't realize what it takes to go through an Orthodox conversion. I will never see them again. And explains to them what it will take to go through an Orthodox conversion. They lived all the way out on a farm, pretty far out. And he said, if you want to go through an Orthodox conversion, you have to live in the Frum community. It's pretty expensive. And you would have to keep Shabbos. He was a lineman at a power company. That's actually how he and my husband connected, because my husband is obsessed with Erev. They became best friends through that. But he said, you know, your job, you have to work on Shabbos. I don't know if you're going to be able to do this. And he explained to them everything that they would have to go through to go through an Orthodox conversion, and he never expected to see them again. But they really made the effort, and they started to keep Chagim. I think Shavuos was the first Chag. And they started to keep kashrus, even though it's difficult to keep kashrus in Charleston. And she used to cook very Southern recipes. She's actually a daughter of the Confederacy. So she had definitely had very Southern recipes. And slowly, slowly, they started to keep Shabbos. And it was really difficult for him. He would, on his days that he was supposed to work on Shabbos, he would trade it with somebody else. There was a lot of anti-Semitism in his company. People used to say to him, oh, I dropped a penny on the floor, Jew, go pick it up. There was one Shabbos where they had like a fair. I'm not really sure why. It was a company fair. And they told him, you cannot switch off. You actually have to be here. And it was freezing cold that Shabbos. And he stayed in a hotel on the Friday nights. And Shabbos morning, he had to walk there in the morning. And there was no way to heat up. Everyone else, walked to their hotel afterward. But I think it was out of Tom Shabbos. I forget exactly what the story was. He and my husband built an Erev around the perimeter of the place so that he could at least eat his food, but he had no way to heat up his food on Shabbos. And all Shabbos long, he spent there in the winter, freezing cold, in order to keep Shabbos with this Erev around. And that was how he didn't do any work, but he was there. And all Shabbos long, I was so worried about him, but he is very tough and he was able to do it. But it was very, very difficult for him to keep Shabbos. It was very difficult for him to keep kashrut. Their family was not so supportive of their choices, and they were all local, and it was very, very difficult for them. But they kept up with this path. They moved into the Frum community, they kept their home in the farm area, and they moved into the expensive Frum area because that was what they had to do. And even after they became fully Shabbos, fully Shomer Shabbos, and fully Shomer Kashrut, there were a lot of administrative difficulties through the Beit Din that really took a long time to get through. And she was already 30 years old. They wanted to just get married already, but they kept getting delayed. And finally, we got the phone call that morning. This was a crazy story. And Beit Din told us, okay, we're ready to do the conversion that day in Atlanta, 5-hour drive away. So we all jumped in the car together, my husband and I, my three kids, one of them was in camp, and this couple, and we drove to Atlanta, the 5-hour drive. And we got there, and I was able to be her attendant as she had gone through the mikvah. And she came out, and I can't even tell you the look of light that was on her face. It was the most beautiful moments in the world. And afterward, everyone in the community was so nervous around her, like no one wants to speak Lashon Hara, and like put any smirch on her fresh Jewish soul. She had such an enthusiasm for mitzvot. 3 weeks later, they had their wedding in the shul. It was amazing. They actually put together the most beautiful wedding in 3 weeks. It was Labor Day weekend. Eitan Katz, they had heard him play Lamancha on the way down to the conversion, and they decided this is who we want at our wedding. And I was like, you're not gonna get Eitan Katz 3 weeks before your wedding with that notice on Labor Day weekend. By some miracle, he was free. He flew down to Charleston, wrote on his Facebook page what an amazing experience it was to be in Charleston for this wedding. It was the most powerful experience I had ever seen. And it was only a few days later that it was Rosh Hashanah, and I can't even explain to you what it is to be standing in shul on Rosh Hashanah with somebody who really, two people who changed their entire lives to become Jewish or to become from. It was such a schus, like you really felt like, I'm so glad to be here because whatever bad things I did this year, I have him in my shul, I have her in my shul, and I can piggyback on their schusim, on their merits. Fast forward a year later, he's still working at this company, they're still giving him a very hard time. And they'd had a baby named after his grandfather, whose death really started this whole process. And shortly before Rosh Hashanah, he was fired for keeping Shabbos. And my husband and I said to him, you know, you could speak to this lawyer, that lawyer, they're all happy to help you to sue. And he said, I don't want to sue. I just want to keep moving on with my life. And I'm going to rebuild. Everything happens for a purpose. And he's standing there in shul on Rosh Hashanah shortly after he'd lost his job. And once again, I'm feeling like, oh my God, I have never heard of anybody who sacrificed to keep Shabbos like I've seen with this man. And he really just believes everything happens for a reason. Baruch Hashem, he now has a company of his own. He builds docks. He has a boat. I kid you not, the name of his boat, it's stenciled in Hebrew, Parnassa. In Hebrew, his boat in Charleston says Parnassa. And he is so successful now, so much more than he ever was as a lineman. And really, it was just such an inspiring thing to see. What I really learned from all of these experiences, even people who did not fully become from, but really what I've learned is it's not about how far you get on the ladder, but it's really just how far you've come. I saw so many people who didn't become from, but really made minyan a priority. And they, again, would go to oyster parties afterward, but it was so important to them to come to minyan. It was such a powerful thing for me to see. I saw people who weren't from at all, but really prioritized kavod hamit, that it was so important to them that we have a nice showing at every funeral to give respect to people who had passed away, people who are on the chevra kadisha, who would spend all hours of the night and day doing chevra kadisha, who weren't from at all. These people were the most kind-hearted people that I had ever met. And for some of them, just to come to shul after not being there for a while was a huge accomplishment. To send to a Jewish day school was a huge accomplishment. For people who had, for people who come to a class was a huge accomplishment. The sister of this man who I just spoke about, so his sister actually was married to a non-Jewish man, and he was a non-Jewish man who was in the Marines, and he was stationed in Bahrain, first in Spain, and then in Bahrain. And she struggled to keep Judaism, much more than she ever had in Charleston, while in Spain, and while in Bahrain. And recently, the military ended. Actually, they would keep, they started having a Seder in Bahrain. From what she had seen from her brother and sister-in-law, she really started to bring Judaism to Bahrain and to Spain. And recently, thank God, they left Bahrain, they came to Washington, D.C., and her father came to hang up a mezuzah. And she said, for 6 years, I've wanted to hang up a mezuzah so badly, but I couldn't. In Spain and Bahrain, you just can't do those things. But finally, after 6 years, I'm able to make that bracha of hanging up a mezuzah. This is a woman who is not from at all, but this is what she had seen from her family. His parents came such a long way. These are the beautiful things that we saw in Charleston. So what did it do to this from girl from New York seeing all of these stories? So I saw Shabbos in a new light. Shabbos was always something I'd always kept. I'd kept every Shabbos in my life. But now I'm seeing people who are choosing to keep Shabbos. I'm seeing people who are sacrificing to keep Shabbos. Mikvah, okay, mikvah. We all know you get married, you're going to go to the mikvah. But when I saw women who were not from at all, but would sacrifice to go to the mikvah every single month, all of a sudden I saw mikvah the way they saw mikvah, as something meaningful, as something inspiring, as something that was really worth doing. Judaism to me had always been given on a silver platter, and now I'm really seeing people who are really willing to sacrifice, and through their sacrifice, I was able to see Judaism in a whole different way. And I started seeing assimilation in a totally different way. See, assimilation, we all think, means that I'm assimilating to become like, you know, not Jewish culture. But I think assimilation can also mean something else, because so often we hear about assimilation, we say it's so bad. But what does it have to do with us who live Jewish lives, especially those of us in Israel, who thank God are really privileged to live very meaningful Jewish lives? And I think assimilation can sometimes mean to take, not to take our life for granted, but really to see our life and become like the dominant culture. So many of us, like me, kept Judaism for such a long time because that's just what's done. We were raised Jewish, we were raised from, and that's why we send our kids to Jewish day schools, and that's why we keep Shabbos, and that's why we keep kosher, and that's why we go to the mikvah, and maybe that's why our husbands go to minyan. But when we do things because that's the culture around us, it starts to lose its meaning. And perhaps that's assimilation in its own way, because we're losing our meaning to what that Judaism is. And there's two things that can come from this. Number one, when we lose our passion for what we're doing, or maybe we didn't even have a passion in the first place, it's hard to transmit that to our children, because they see it as, okay, that's just what you always did. And when they're challenged in their Judaism, as we see so many kids are today, they don't have that passion to hold on to it. So that's one piece. But number two, it loses its meaning for ourselves. Once I was in Charleston and I saw people really sacrificing for Shabbos, and I saw what they saw in Shabbos, Shabbos really meant something so much more to me. It really became a gift. It really became that gift of, I have 25 hours to spend with my family to really immerse myself in learning, in davening. My Shabbos candles, all of a sudden I saw Shabbos candles in the way that I saw everybody else when they started lighting their Shabbos candles anew. I started seeing mikvah the same way, in a totally new way, when I saw people who had made that choice to keep it. And I realized that to be a Maccabi is basically, for a frum person, that means to fight for your own Judaism. And sometimes it's not fighting against Judaism, against enemies who are trying to extinguish it, but sometimes it's fighting for your own Judaism from rote, keeping Judaism in a rote way. And so therefore, when I come to Hanukkah, when I light my Hanukkah candles, I think about all of the different experiences of assimilation that I saw that really broke my heart. You never lose the brokenheartedness of seeing this. There was one situation since we left Charleston of this man who was so connected. He went to a Jewish day school. He would lane. He'd love to lane. But he met a non-Jewish woman, and they were friends, and then they were dating, and he wasn't going to marry her, and they recently became engaged. And he knows that it's not the best thing, but what can you do? These stories never stop breaking your heart. But at the same time, I also think about the Maccabim that I saw in Charleston, about people who were willing to fight for their Judaism, who were really willing to sacrifice for their Judaism in ways that I had only read about in books, but got to experience when I lived in Charleston. And so when I light my Hanukkah candles and I think about all of the Hellenists that we think about Hanukkah, I also think about triumphing over that. And I want to end off by a piece by Rav Soloveitchik, because I said to Zmira, I can bring in sources. And she's like, no, just tell the story. So I'm just going to bring off this last story, that sometimes I would look at everything around me and I would be like, how can, these people are so far gone. How will they ever come back? And it's amazing how many times my husband said that. And we really were surprised by people who did come back. But we definitely saw people who were really far off. And Rav Soloveitchik says as follows, that he says that we have the animamins, we have the ideas that we say that I believe in this and I believe in that. And we say that we believe that Mashiach will come, that even if Mashiach delays, we believe that Mashiach will come. Says Rav Soloveitchik that also according to the Rambam, Mashiach won't come until everybody does teshuva. It's a debate about whether Mashiach will come before everybody does teshuva, if it will only happen after everyone does teshuva. And the belief, how can we reconcile those two beliefs? So believe in Mashiach means that we believe in the ability of Am Yisrael, of the Jewish people, to do teshuva, to repent, and to come back. We were really privileged to see stories of people we never, ever thought would come back. And I think the idea that we learn from this is to have the belief in Am Yisrael, to reach out to somebody, that neighbor that we have who may not be religious, to smile at them and say, Good Shabbos. When we first came to Beit Shemesh, so everyone around us is mostly from, but there are a few people who are not from. I go to a shul a little bit further away because I wanted to go to an Israeli shul. And when I come back, I see a lot of chilonim. And I'm very, very makbid to always smile at everyone, and not in a judgmental way, but smile and say, Good Shabbos. And very often someone will stop me and they'll say, Good Shabbos back. But one person stopped me actually right near my home. And he said, Thank you for saying Good Shabbos to me. And I said, Why? And he said, So many times from people don't. And for me, this is Shabbos too. And even if I keep my Shabbos differently from everyone, I appreciate you reaching out to me and saying Good Shabbos. And whether it's smiling at someone saying Good Shabbos or inviting them for a Shabbos meal, if we think that that's not pushing too much, to never give up faith in Am Yisrael and the Jewish people around us, to always reach out, because every Jew has that pinsel yid, crazy stories that we had seen. And the more we reach out, the more we can help bring back other people in Am Yisrael. So I will tell you something that someone in our shul said to me, and it really changed my perspective. So he was not from, he actually went to an Orthodox shul, and when he moved to Charleston, he was a New Yorker, when he moved to Charleston, he joined our shul. He was very against Reform and conservative. And this is what he said to me. He said that, "I'm not from, I don't eat kosher, I don't keep Shabbos, but I know that that's the right thing to do. I'm just able to admit myself that I'm not ready for it." As opposed to what he was saying about Reform and conservative, is that they believe that what they're doing is right. They don't want to accept that what they're doing is wrong. And therefore they say, okay, you know, Judaism should change because that's not what I want it to be. And I had a lot of respect for what he said, that he was willing to admit he's wrong, because once we're willing to admit that we're wrong, only then can we really open that path to coming back, as opposed to saying that Judaism should change. I thought it was a very interesting perspective and a very honest one, and really the room to growth for anybody, wherever we're coming from, is always to admit that I have more to grow. So I thought that was a very interesting idea. So thank you, Zmira, for inviting me to speak. I've actually been invited to share our story in several venues in Hebrew. So this was very exciting to do this in my native language and not have to chomp through my story. Thank you so much for listening, and Chodesh Tov to y'all.